Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Car Chat Podcast. I'm Sam Moores and with me today I have Tim Fanner. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast, I say. I'm in your establishment.
That's good.
Can you tell the audience a little bit about sort of who you are, what you do?
So basically I was a kid at heart who just likes smashing around with cars. And my first car was an Austin Healey Sprite, same as an MG Midget. And in having that car, I loved it, restored it. My dad had a garage, and so I restored it in his garage. And I kept breaking gearboxes. Did 85 gearboxes in 18 months. And I just finished studying motor vehicle engineering and business studies. And I thought, I've got to do something about this. Car's mess of my head now. And developed a 5-speed gearbox conversion for it. And that's how it all started.
Had you worked on sort of stuff at that point in time, or you were just like, I've got a car, I can probably fix this?
Yeah, so my dad was a graduate engineer, and so he had his own garage, but before that he was a design engineer for various other firms. And so I learned my engineering skills from him. Although I went to college and studied engineering as well, I didn't learn much. I learned all the main skills from him. And so when I said I wanted to do this conversion, he said, right, let's sit down and do it. And we drew it out on a piece of paper, we designed the kit, built it, put it in the car, and the rest is history.
How did it go?
Amazing. It was just something like, gosh, I've got a gearbox, it's quieter, I've got a better drivetrain. Then I instantly thought, I can have more power now.
Yeah.
So I started learning about more power and tuning. And then I thought, suspension and brakes aren't up to this now, I need to learn about that. And I'm a very connective learner, so I need to get alongside people with the right skill sets to really get into something and understand it. And so I found people that were really good at brakes and really good at suspension and learned from them and then designed bits for my car.
Nice. And then at what point did Frontline come along?
So pretty much the same time. The gearbox conversion, I invited Practical Classics to come down and have a look at it. So, and I think it was Paul Skilleter back then in the day. Mm-hmm. And he came down and did an article on it and just said, this is brilliant. It's really, really good. And nobody's done anything like this before. Yeah. And so that's kind of where it started. He did an article on it. We had people phoning up almost straight away saying, I have the same problems. Could you do a kit for me? And I just got married and my wife was working. We'd got a house, and but we could kind of afford to live off her income just about if we were careful.
Yeah.
So I said, look, can I give this a go? Because I think there might be something in this and it's something fun and we both like cars. And so we did. And that's how the business started.
Nice. And at that point in time, how were people finding out about it?
Just reading in magazines. There was no internet.
Yeah.
Mobile phones barely existed and they were just bricks with buttons that you did nothing. And so it was literally just a magazine article. A magazine article would come out with a telephone number, would come through to me, and that was it.
Nice. And so how much did it grow at that point doing the conversion?
I think we did 11 conversions in the first year, which, considering nobody'd ever heard of it before, I think was quite good going. And it was, so that was the first bit. And it was back in 94, I think, that we incorporated into a limited company, because we've grown to a size where we've got other products now. We've got suspension and brake products. And we needed to sort of put it on a more formal platform, and took on my first main employee, who's actually still with us working
that's,
today.
That's good going. Was that quite a stressful addition? Going, yes. Like, I'm now employing someone.
As soon as you're employing people, you've got responsibility for them. To make sure there's enough money coming in and can pay the bills, which when you're a small company, well, yeah, any company is always a challenge at times. But yeah, going that transition from doing my own thing to employing somebody was really difficult, especially as I've never actually been employed by anybody. So I've got no knowledge of what that's like. So yeah. To suddenly take that on and then be directing people to do what I do want to do was alien to me.
Yeah. And then did what you were doing day to day shift? I presume that has shifted quite a lot over the period up until now.
Yeah. So in those early days, you do everything. You design things, you make the prototypes, you have them manufactured, you build the kits up, you advertise it, you speak to the suppliers, speak to the customers, the trade customers, and just do everything and drive around the country trying to find parts.
Yeah. To a little bit of everything. And then, so at what point in time did you start making like a product? When did the LE50, was that the first?
The LE50 was the first resto mod. Up to that point, we built and restored loads of cars for people. When I say built, I mean as in ground up restorations.
Okay.
As opposed to just doing a kit here and there.
Yeah.
But up to that point, it was always led by the customer. Mm-hmm. And some customers know what they want, but the majority don't have enough experience about the whole concept, designing concept of a vehicle, to understand what difference putting sound deadening into the car makes,
yeah,
to stiffening something up, to enhancing the way the dynamics of the vehicle feel so you get more feedback on. They don't understand those things. And the slightest change you make on a vehicle in any area can impact the joy or the pleasure of driving the vehicle at the end of the day, which ultimately is what it's about. And why I still do it, it's because I like messing around with cars. I like the pleasure of driving something that drives the way I want it to drive.
Yeah.
And so that's in 2012, what was 2011, we had the idea of doing a vehicle that was with all the things in it that we wanted to put into it, mm, that we knew would actually work. And we set about it, and that was the LE50.
2011. And at that point in time, this sort of resto mod idea, I guess, had been around for a while. I know, I'm not really, were you, who was doing it around that time? Was anyone doing it around the time?
I honestly don't know anybody that was doing, there were people restoring cars.
Yeah.
But somebody saying, this is a collection of everything, the best we do, and putting into one package and saying, this is a package. I don't think there was anybody else doing that. And I wouldn't like to say that we were the first people to do a resto mod, but the term resto mod didn't exist.
Yeah.
And it was coined after that.
What did you call it then?
We just called it the Frontline LE50, yeah, to celebrate 50 years of the MGB. And that was it. There was no resto mod term. And a few people have said they think we probably are the forefront or the first to do resto mods. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely early.
Oh yeah, sure.
Definitely early. And like, when you start doing that, and you're saying, you know, you've picked all the sort of bits and done all the sort of stuff that you think need doing. And as a random person who's, let's say I was going to buy a car, I wouldn't have a clue. What were some of the things that you're like, oh, okay, we've got to fix fundamental issues? Were there a lot of things with the fundamentals of the car that had to be changed?
It was really interesting. I had a conversation, if I go off piece a tiny bit.
Totally.
There's a chap called Don Hayter, who was the original draftsman and designer of the MGB. And he lived, he's passed away now, but he lived 3 miles up the road from here. And we invited him to come in and see what we do. It was the car club actually invited him to come in and see what he did, what we do. And he walked in the door, I think he was 72 at the time. And he was like, this is the car we wanted to build. And I went, in what way? He says, you've got 5-link suspension. The first 5 MG prototypes had 5-link suspension on the rear.
Nice.
And he showed me a picture in a book that we've got downstairs. I'd never clocked what was in there. of this 5-link suspension in the back of this car.
Nice.
And the front suspension was supposed to have been a double wishbone front suspension. It was supposed to have been a V4 engine and all kinds of things that would have elevated the technology of it. He got in the car, drove it, and was just blown away. And within, I don't know, 2 minutes, he was drifting out of junctions and sliding it. And I'm going, it's got 72 and he can pedal still. I was impressed. And he came back and just said, that's the car we wanted to build, but we weren't allowed to build.
That's cool.
Yeah. So for me, that was amazing because I put my heart and soul into what I wanted for the car to be. And then for that person to say, this is the car we wanted it to be.
And that's
incredible.
That's a really interesting sort of conversation in itself about a lot of cars is some people, I don't know whether I know any, but I'm sure there are lots of people, they sort of get very specific about this is how the car came out of factory.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an interesting conversation because you could go, right, but it's been changed a bit since then. People have tried to change stuff, whatever. But what was the intended, like what if the people who were making it then could have sort of done the stuff they wanted without all of the budgetary constraints and design constraints and whatever, what would it have looked like? And like, is departing from that original thing a bad thing, a good thing? Different, who knows, you know, what do people prefer?
I think you can typically, when I look at other makes of vehicles, which I'm sure you'll probably ask me about later on, vehicles that interest me, it's always the Mark 1.
Right.
The first of the edition.
Okay.
Because that's always the purest in my mind. Sometimes manufacturers manage to get back into that purity and create something special again. But on the whole, it's that vehicle that has that real DNA.
Well, what do you think would be some standout examples of that?
The early split screen camper, the early Sprites and MGs, the early Healeys, all the later ones had more and more features added to them, just made them slower, heavier,
yeah.
All the Jaguars. So, you know, go back to something like an XK120, it's got beautiful styling. Yeah, there were some compromises and things because it was designed, that was, the car was designed just to showcase the engine.
Mm.
It wasn't to sell as a car. They never intended to sell as a car, but the concept of that is a beautiful car.
Yeah. It is interesting looking at those sorts of things. Like an example of not many cars keep developing. They stop making them. They might only make them for 10 years or whatever it is. And they might be two versions or the only one I could think of that's still going is the 911. And that has changed so much since the original. When I look at them now, I sort of swing from the very modern to the very original as like the sort of, like, I quite fancy like an early short wheelbase car and then something really modern. And then like where you want to go in the middle is sort of up to you. But it's interesting looking at different cars, like E-types, it's always the first ones that everyone wants.
And I think with the thing with the whole resto mod scene is people like you know, like the new Porsches because they're so good. But the nostalgia, you want to have the old one because of the looks and the feel of it. And it's a lot of people don't like driving a modern Ferrari because the aggro they get for driving one.
Yeah.
But a classic one, people just,
it's cool.
It's beautiful. It's cool. But you get into a classic of any kind that hasn't been modernized in some way, and you probably won't use it much.
Yeah.
Because they're really hard to live with by comparison of what we're used to. And that's what we do is, you know, I like these cars to be able to live, I like to use them. And every time I set a design point, there's a kind of a 3-point design point. One is it's got to be usable as an everyday vehicle.
Right.
It's got to be reliable and strong enough to do that and jump in, drive to Scotland, do the NC500 or go down to the Alps or the Pyrenees, whatever. Without question. And then the other one is it's got to have some practicality. So it's got to be easy to live with. Otherwise, you won't use it when you go into town or to the shops or something like that. And then it's got to be capable of taking it on a track. You know, not necessarily full-blown racing, but go and do a track day or get a really hard pasting around the Alps or something like that. And then still come back and just pot around and enjoy it. And for me, that's the holy grail, the trinity of what the car needs to deliver. And that's what we do. We then tailor the cars to individuals' needs. So we'll always do little things for them just to make them very personal for themselves.
Yeah, because each person has their own particular use case, car collection, state of mind. That's what I was talking about. I went for a little drive earlier and I was actually talking about this. I was saying it's really difficult to give your opinion on a car, for example. You can give this is my opinion on this day at this time based on the scenario that I find myself in. Like, you might be in a bad headspace and you like, I've got to do a really long journey. So in reality, you just want something really comfy that you don't have to touch and you just be in the wrong car. So you fall out with that car. But you could be in the Alps, you've got 20 minutes and you just want to go have something like mad, set your hair on fire, then put it away and go something else. Do you have a sort of typical customer or what? Where do lots of these cars sort of go to? Do they have people have lots of cars, no cars, old cars, new cars?
It's a real mix. We've got quite a few customers that have several cars. One of the things that makes me happiest is when they actually sell some of those cars because they're just using our car as their main car. And that always makes me feel good. And that happens quite a lot. We've got quite a lot of customers that do a lot of miles. We've got customers in Norway, for example, who will drive their car here, have a service, then go off down through Spain, Portugal, do all that, bring it back here. Maybe haven't done 6,000 miles in a few weeks, come back here, have another service, sometimes leave it here and then go back off to Europe again later in the year. And then we've got customers in Switzerland and Germany and Holland and, well, all over the world, loads in the States and Canada as well. We don't get to see those ones as much, but most of the European ones will drive back here once a year for a service and just do a road trip and come and see some friends in the UK. Yeah. So you've got some friends here as well. And we've got a few customers that just use them as an occasional hobby car, but most of them use them.
That's cool. Mm. And for a car that's based on an old car, now, when were the MGB cars coming out?
So first was 62.
To then be comfortable getting in something like that and driving it a lot, and just being like, I'm going to sit on the motorway, blah, 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 do all these things. That is really cool. When we were having a look around downstairs, sort of various cars were being pointed out. I think one was pointed out and was saying this owner had a bunch of, I think, older cars and has sold a few of them to buy one of the frontline cars because it's going to run.
Yeah. We chose the Mazda drivetrain initially because it's so durable. And then we didn't just upgrade that. All the suspension is upgraded, all the electrics are upgraded. And then, as we said earlier, the sound deadening. And then you can have decent audio because if you've got good sound deadening, you can actually listen to music in those cars, which sometimes you want to do, or listen to a podcast sort of stuff. And other times you just want to have the windows down and listen to the soundtrack of the car. But yeah, it is a case of they're there to be used. They have 10,000 mile service interval. We say if you're doing track day stuff, we try not to bring it down to 6,000 miles. And that's it. It's just service is done in 3 hours.
Yeah.
In and out.
That is cool. That is cool. And that idea, I was thinking about various, like, you know, people I know that own different sorts of, like, I'm very much in the sort of, have had a bunch of modern cars, had some slightly older cars, but I'm sort of more in that field. Whereas I've got a family member who, now that I think about it, I think has like 20 old cars. And the fact that I don't know what they are, I need to go and visit him and find out. But I suspect he has a lot of that sort of area, 50s, 60s, that sort of stuff, which I presume most of it, I know sometimes you have to be taking them to MOTs and stuff, but I presume a lot of stuff doesn't run. And I could see, do you think people, I don't know whether you personally have been through this, you go through a journey of going, I want to own X car. And then the reality of like, do I use it? If I use it, how much do I have to then look after it? And do people go through a sort of ownership journey, sort of cycle of trying stuff and then coming back and then going, okay, yeah, I can see why you might want to have one.
They do. And lots of them keep coming back to the same thing, whether that be a Porsche or an MG or a Jaguar or whatever it is. But once you start getting up to the level of detail that we go into the cars and the resto mod world of people that really go through the fine detail of the cars, the customers are educated. They're very aware of what's going on. They're not just buying one of these on a whim.
Yeah.
Occasionally you get someone that says, oh, so-and-so said I've got to drive one of these, I'll have one of these in my life, and I trust them, so they just say they'll have one. But most people are They've been through the process. They've restored some cars. They've had cars modernized or things like that. And so they've become, they're much more aware and they know what they want. And when they see something like this, they go, I can see the work's gone into that. That's what I want.
Yeah. Does it make it, we should talk in a bit about the various sort of things you offer and whatnot. What's the sort of price swing between the petrol engine cars that you do? Because you do an EV now. What do they sort of start at and what have they sort of ended up at?
Around the 120 and up to about 170.
And that's plus the base car. Has it been difficult? Because you can pick up an MGB for, I don't know, $5,000? I actually have no idea.
You can pick them up for less than that.
Okay. So less than $5,000. With some of the other resto mod companies, well, lots of the cars are, let's say, 50 to 100, maybe more, if it's some crazy Ferrari that someone wants to restore. Has that been an interesting journey of going, you can spend up getting towards, you know, $200,000 on an MGB? Have you seen that change quite a lot over time? And has that been the sort of interesting process of talking to people about it and stuff?
I think it's changed. I think when we first started doing this, because there wasn't a benchmark, nobody really knew where to pitch things. And some of the resto mods out there are astronomical money. I think ours are genuine. It's a genuine number. The development over the years of the options of other things that people can do. And I think, you know, you can go for cars that are, you know, really hardcore driving machines, right up to just super comfortable luxury. Mm. And it's finding that balance. And I think we kind of strike the balance. We can swing to either of those spectrums and develop a car or build a car to somebody's own needs to suit that, which we do quite regularly.
And the car I drove today.
Yes.
How do the specs sort of vary? What are the sort of ends of the spectrum in terms of like a more Tory type car to a sort of more hardcore?
Yeah, so that one is slightly more hardcore. Okay. So it's a more track focused, but you can dial it down really easy. So at the moment it's on a more road suspension setting. We changed the geometry and changed the spring and damper setting, so it's more road orientated and put more road orientated tires. Whereas last year, September, I put it into its track mode, took it out to France to do a track day with a group of friends and gave some serious piece of machinery a hard time out there.
Nice. And that was as one of the more hardcore, okay, did you change the suspension out? Or did you just change the settings?
Just the settings.
Because I would say that was really comfy. It was like super comfy, surprisingly comfy.
So, a lot of the suspension work that I learned from a chap called Roddy Harvey Bailey. He was test driver for Colin Chapman, and he was also a Formula One test driver and suspension design engineer.
How did you come across this chap?
Through Roger Cook Report. So Roger Cook was the pioneer of the investigative journalists.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you look him up, he's still around, but he's not active working these days. And he had a Costello MG, which is a V8 modified MG that Ken Costello made in the 90s, I think it was, 80s, 90s. And I wanted to go to the next level of development with multi-link suspension on the rear suspension. And he said, you need to have a chat with Roddy. So we drove up there, had a chat with Roddy, and I learned a load from him. And then between us, we designed this new suspension for the MGB, which is what's on there. And one of the things that Roddy taught me was that hard suspension doesn't necessarily mean good suspension. And so over the years, we've got softer and softer with the suspension, and there's recent years, we've worked with Nitron, you know, Nitron dampers. Mm-hmm. And
they do a lot of rally stuff?
They started doing motorbike stuff. Now they do, so they're main supplier for Lotus. They do loads of Pro Drive, loads of Porsche, and things like that, really high-end stuff. And they're only 15 minutes away from here, 20 minutes away from here. And Guy, the owner of it, is really into his motorbikes as well. And he and I get on really well. And he has an MG. And I said, any chance you could do something for us? And he went, I'd love to. I've been wanting to do something for you for ages. So we sat down and worked with his team. And I said, my brief to you is I want softer, more compliant, but more grip.
Nice.
And he went,
that's what I want.
Okay, we do that. And that's what you've just driven today. And it's the levels of grip, the confidence it inspires with it is just phenomenal.
It was, so we went for, I don't know, 20 minutes out. We drove probably 10 minutes, swapped over 10 minutes. And I sat in the seat. I was just like, this is just really, I don't know, like that seat is really comfortable. Mm-hmm. That seat in that car for me was great. I know you do some option sort of stuff around the seats. What's the situation with the seats?
So we couldn't get an off-the-shelf seat that was really comfortable. We used to use the Mazda MX-5 Mark 1 seats. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty good, quite comfortable. But we couldn't get the adjustment in there because car manufacturer seats are designed for the 95th percentile of users. So, you know, that's a wide spectrum.
And that's evolved quite a lot over the last
years. And so what we do is we designed our own seat frame and seat mounting mechanism. So this is our base setup that's in the car, which is what you sat in there. And then every customer comes in and we have a seat fitting and we'll stack the foams and change the foams in the seat until they go, right, I'm super comfortable with this. And then we'll get them a cup of coffee and a magazine, just leave them there for a while.
Yeah.
And come back and go, hey, you're still comfortable. And to this day, we always get customers come back and go, this is the most comfortable car I've ever been in. And we've had customers with, you know, bought his Mercedes SL,
yeah,
something crazy in, and said, please, can you work on the seats on that? Because they're not comfortable enough. Your MG is so much more comfortable than that. And we modified the seats for his car.
Nice.
Which is crazy.
It's genuinely great. That it was really comfy. And there were just the way the armrest, which is also nice and padded, is just there.
But even that, the height of the armrest and the position of it, we set to the person.
Okay. Because whoever's it's set to is very similar to me.
Yeah. So everybody's got slightly different arm lengths, body lengths, everything like that. So to give you an example, my wife and I went to Southern Italy a few years ago. Went then, she's got a 62 MGB Roadster. And we went down as far as Amalfi. And then from Amalfi, we drove all the way back up to Portofino in the one day along the coast road. That's a long drive.
But that was good.
I think it was about 640 miles.
That's far.
Yeah. And we got there, got to the hotel and got out of the car, went in, had a shower, went down for dinner. Just fine. Yeah. After doing that kind of distance, most people, if I did that in a modern car, I would be tired and aching and knackered.
Yeah.
But we had the roof down, we cruised along the coast, just drove all day. Stop for petrol and a sandwich, and that was it.
Nice. Do they sit at, like, because you don't have cruise control or any of that sort of stuff. What's the sort of natural motorway speed that they sort of
depends
sit
on
at?
What country you're sitting in.
But does the sort of engine have like a nice place, or actually it will sort of do whatever?
It depends. Again, it depends on the engine, and okay, then we do different gear ratios, drivetrain ratios as well. So the one you've been out in today, its sweet spot is about 85, 90.
Okay.
And it'll sit at that all day long. I did a stint overseas last year where we did about an hour and a half, 120.
That's going covering, along.
Covering some ground, yeah.
Little MGB.
But the car will do 160. So it's...
What does it feel like at 160? Have you done 160?
Yeah, I have actually. It's surprisingly okay. I mean, I'm always nervous of any car at those kind of speeds because...
If something goes wrong...
Yeah. And brakes play a much bigger part than people realize. Most people don't realize if you're doing 100 plus miles an hour in almost any modern car, unless it's a performance one, and you try to stop in one go, you won't. You'll overheat your brakes. And, you know, it's only something that's
really?
Designed. Yeah. You just, the brakes aren't designed to do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're in a Range Rover, for example, you know, doing 100 miles an hour,
and you
try to stop. But, you know, the same will happen with a lot of modern cars, unless they are built for that more performance driving. And our cars will do that easily.
Nice. And then the brakes is I want to rewind a tiny bit, because you also do a seat fitting for the passenger.
Yes.
Which I've not come across before.
Partners aren't always the same size as each other.
This is true.
So we've got one lady owner, and she has longer legs than her husband, and noticeably so. So we tailored the seats, and what we found a way of doing an insert swap that we could swap from one to the other, so they were both perfectly comfortable. So the same base seat, but then insert swap for him or for her, and they just swap them around.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact is, he doesn't get to drive the car. He's not allowed to drive it. She drives it all the time.
But the option's there, because I guess that is the thing. Like, it's you're not always going to have the same person driving. I think someone was saying people have done it with their kid as the passenger and trim
the booster seat
as an adult.
By now, yes, but we trim the booster seat. So that's the car, that one of those ones, that particular customer has an LE50, had the booster seat trimmed in the same leather. He now keeps that, doesn't need it anymore, and is now having that vehicle converted to electric.
Okay.
And he's going to pass that on to his son as an electric version. So it has a journey that evolves over the years.
And with the brakes are they assisted or unassisted? And with the brakes, as you say, being upgraded, et cetera, is it easy to lock up the front?
We do three levels of brakes, effectively. So we do our standard road spec, so like a touring spec brake, and then the sports spec, which is the one you just drove. And with that one, yes, you can lock them, but unlike because there's no ABS traction control or anything on these cars, so you have to make the car or the driver feel driver centric in the car, so you feel like you're at the center point of everything, and that way you can feel what the brakes are doing, you can feel what the traction is doing. And you can very quickly just explore the limits of the vehicle and just know what you're capable of. And you can feel what the brakes are doing before you start to lock it. So, yes, you can lock them, but you just instinctively know what's going on all the time.
And I guess you adjust it so that it's not like I've applied 20% brake and that's it. Off we go.
No. If you drive a modern vehicle, the brake force tends to be quite similar regardless of what you do with the pedal, because it's all modulated and controlled by computers. Whereas ours isn't. The harder you push, the harder you brake. But we've got a really good servo, so that gives you the assist on there. And then the balance of it, because what you want is the whole vehicle to kind of squat. You don't want the car to pitch and dive.
Yeah.
You want the whole vehicle to squat. So we've got rear disc brakes as well. And then next step up from that is different pad materials for different types of uses. And then with the V8s, we go right up to a 6-pot 310mm, which I know we're getting into techie speed now, but basically that you can, if you want to stand it on its nose, you can stand it on
when
its nose.
When you're going 160 and you want to stop.
You just stop.
You stop.
It's an amazing experience. The acceleration and the braking are such that you reach speeds incredibly quickly, but then you can wipe that speed off and just retard it so fast that you just feel really comfortable and comfortable.
Yeah.
You just know what it's going to do.
And it's like the one I went to say, that is quick. That is not a slow, that is a quick car.
That's a 4-second, sub-4-second, motor 60 car.
which is, you're like, okay, that in my head I went, that's enough. Like for this car, that is definitely enough. But see, you've now done a V8.
Yes.
Where did the idea for the V8 come from?
So V8s have been put in MGs before, and I don't know, as time goes on, my brain's always ticking away, and my engineering brain, I'm always thinking of the next feel and sensation. And most of my design engineering with cars is a sensation, it's a feeling. I feel the dynamics and I feel what I want the car to do. And that car now drives the way I had this imaginary car in my mind. And that's the result of it. But I wanted a lot more power, but control and refinement. So we completely redesigned the induction system, the engine internals, the cylinder heads, everything. So it's effectively a new version of the Rover V8 engine, which is incredibly tough. And that the internals will take 750 horsepower if you force induct it, which we'd never do. 375 in that spec is ample.
Yeah.
And we do an S version, which could take sort of 410. It's a bit revvier, a bit you know, blippier on the throttle, but. Whether you'd ever explore that on the road, I don't know.
That's punchy.
This is punchy, yeah. Even at 375 brake, that's punchy.
Yeah, because what are they? Are they like 1,100 kilos?
Almost identical weight to the original B series engine, which was cast iron, because these are an aluminium engine. So the whole that car weighs, I think it's 1,132 kilos.
Okay.
But that's fully trimmed with sound deadening, wet weight.
All the stuff.
Everything in there.
Yeah.
So that's a decent power to weight ratio.
I imagine that's quite pokey.
That's lovely. It sounds incredible.
And you say you're sort of trying to design the car that you're looking for at that sort of point in time. Has that shifted? Do you want a different car now to 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
Yeah. So when I was younger, I just wanted everything to be aggressive and go.
Yeah.
And just that's crazy. And I still do sometimes. But I recognize that it's only for short periods of time that I want to do that.
Yeah.
And I've still got cars that are like that because I still need that buzz of being in something that's really animal. And but then over time, you want refinement but with more performance.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where we've evolved through. So we're now building cars that have even greater levels of performance if you want it. But there's more refinement and more control as well.
Nice.
Yeah. So.
And you're still in this scenario within the realms of an MGB.
Yes.
So you're not in something that weighs 3 tons and there's a Rolls or whatever. It's just like a more refined version or a more raw version. So with that engine, is that electronic fuel injection and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, so it's full engine management system, fly-by-wire throttle, you know, it's all in there.
Because that was one of the things on this car that I drove. So that's on throttle bodies, right? And I've driven some modified 964s that were also on throttle bodies and stuff. And one thing I don't like about that general setup is the initial pedal pressure to sort of get everything moving.
Okay.
Like if you're pressing the pedal, there's like a hard bit to start with, and then you're into the throw and then off you go. This I was fine.
Yeah. And like, the only reason that the reason that they've got that issue is the throttle bodies are not set correctly.
Right.
Because their throttle bodies, to maintain the idle, because they probably haven't got proper idle control on them, they're having to have the throttle plates really closed, which means you've got a vacuum on the plates. So it feels like you almost have to click through that first bit of the pedal travel. Whereas if you've got idle control, which we do on all of our cars, you can have the throttle plates open a little bit more. You don't get that pressure that you need.
Interesting.
So, which means when you're pulling away, you can be refined. And our cars are set. So there's so much tech in them that people just wouldn't even realize, because you know, we've got barrow sensors, atmospheric pressure sensors, and internal in the chamber, in the chambers, we've got pressure sensors. So that allows the computer to control the engine in any altitude, any weather condition, and give it idle and perfect control at any point.
Nice.
Just like you get on a brand new car. It's as close to the new car as you can get, except we haven't got all the silly emissions controls, so we can have the car that just behaves the way we want to.
The way you want to. That was one thing on my backdated SC that I had until very recently that I wanted. I would have loved, if I was to change, the next thing to change, which these things, as you very well know, you're always like, I can change the next thing, the next thing, would have been like a full engine management throttle system. So you just turn it on and it just turn the key, rather than like set the carbs and all that fun stuff. So at what point in time you're doing these really analog, you've done a rowdy one with a V8 in it that's also can be refined, did you go, oh, maybe we should look at doing an EV?
That was customer pressure.
Mm-hmm.
I've got an issue with EV new vehicles. I think the carbon footprints are high. We can go on and on about this because it's a bit of a pet issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I said to our customers that wanted to go EV, if we do it, then we do it the frontline way and we create something that still has a driving experience. Because to my mind, there's no point having something like one of our cars that's just a milk float.
You might as well have a new...
Exactly.
Whatever.
Prius or whatever, just because it's just going to be boring. And you can do it, and it's still, yes, you're still driving a classic. So what we did was two things. We maintained the gearbox. So you've still got a 5-speed gearbox in there.
Okay.
You've still got a flywheel and a clutch. So you drive it like a normal car. And the only difference is that when you're pulling away, you don't use the clutch because the motor isn't spinning.
Do you need to use the clutch to change gears?
Yes. So once you're driving, you drive it like a normal petrol engine car. And then the motor, we've tuned the motor so it behaves like an internal combustion engine. So it rolls up on power and then ramps off when it gets to the top of the cap.
Okay.
And we've given it the same rev range as the original engine. So you get in it and it's like an electric version of an LE50.
Right.
And it's an uncanny experience that you've got the sensation of the noise of the engine and the gearbox, which changes with every gear. The torque amplification changes with every gear. So you feel like you're still engaged in driving and you can downshift coming to a corner and blip the throttle and then accelerate out the corner, just like you can with a normal engine.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's fun. And so we actually, as a collective here, didn't want to like it. Mm. We were doing it out of demand. And when we got it sorted, we were like, I want to take that one home because it's really good fun. So yeah, it's changed all of our minds now.
That is interesting, because I, up until fairly recently, didn't really understand EV conversions that had a gearbox and like why you'd bother in any way, shape or form.
It's a lot more work. It's more expensive. Why would you do it?
And I had this presumption that it doesn't make a difference. Like, you're going to get full torque from zero revs. So it doesn't almost matter what gear, like what's the point in even having gears, like all this. And then I went to see Electrogenic.
Yeah.
And do you get your powertrain from someone else?
We've done joint development.
Who do you use?
It's an in-house development that we use technical partners with. Yeah.
But I was talking to them and they were showing me one of their manual cars and they were like, the thing is, like the motor in that car spec'd with that transmission is revving to max revs, but then you put it through the gearbox and that comes out and you do basically get a 0 to sort of 10,000 RPM sort of type situation. And then you do need to change gear. If you want to go faster, you do need to change gear. And I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. This is different. You have sort of made it more complicated, but at the same time, you're trying to make it driving experience. Oh, maybe there's something in this. And I've not driven one with that setup yet, but
I think for me, if you're going to drive an interesting vehicle or a sports car, you're doing so because you enjoy it. It's not just a case of going to the shops or doing the school run. You're doing it because there's passion there. And for me, everything that we do has to have passion. Otherwise, we don't do it.
Yeah. I found recently, and I think this is an interesting one to look at, if you've got a few cars available to use, and you might have gone, I've bought that one because I love looking at that car and it's like my dream car, and then you find you don't use it. That's quite odd, because you're like, but why am I not using it? You're like, well, actually, it's because some convenience factor. I'm just going to the shops. What's the point in like going through all that process and then overheating and not having any fun? So most of the people that are doing the EVs, is this going to be a car that they're literally driving around town using a lot?
Yes and no. We've got customers now specifying that they want ranges of over 200 miles, which is fine. We can do that.
Yeah.
And more performance. Again, we can do that. I don't think any of them actually live in town. They're all using these cars. One's going to live in Cornwall. Another one is in sort of Cotswolds area.
Yeah.
And yes, there is another one that's going to London at the moment. But that's generally not why. They're just doing it because they just want to enjoy the car.
They want to enjoy it and use it and have something that this sort of EV conversion companies generally seem to talk about is like, and it's just something you've talked about, is they had lots of our customers have an old car or a few old cars and none of them work.
Yeah.
And they're like, if I convert this to EV, I will use it and it will work. Now, you could also do the frontline situation and you'll have a car that will work, but you might have chosen to, for whatever reason, to do EV. I was looking on your website and I think it gives sort of horsepower numbers. Now, horsepower numbers on electric cars, we know, are all a bit funny.
It's a bit weird to work out, yeah.
This is a bit of an odd thing. But I can't remember. I think it, where was it? I actually wrote this down. It was saying 220 newton meters of torque, but it was like 150 brake horsepower, something like that. What's that in performance terms? Is that 8.5 seconds, 8.8? So it's quite okay.
It's not accelerating. But that was the Generation 1 prototype.
Right.
The Gen 2 is 350 newton meters, 240 mile range, and should be about 5.5 seconds, not 60.
That's plenty quicker.
We can do more, but you then start getting into aggressive realms of, you know, if you want to just go full throttle on off the line, it's fine, but there's no driving pleasure with that. And it's, you know, unless that's almost like, you know, getting your V8 engine to 5,000 RPM and dropping the clutch.
Yeah.
Things are going to break, you know, or it's just going to be scary. So having it mapped so it just kind of builds on the power, on the throttle, yeah, it cuts the 0 to 60 time a little bit, but you get the driving experience.
Yeah. And it's a car to enjoy. and drive around it.
That's the point, is to enjoy it.
There'll be someone that will want to put a motor on each wheel and whatever. But like, that's always going to happen. Someone's going to put 1,000 horsepower in a car and burn the wheels off. That's interesting. So, okay, you've got the V8. Are you still doing non-V8 cars?
Yeah, yeah. So we work on everything from the standard B engines or the A engines with the midgets and sprites. We do quite a lot of conversions with MGCs. C is an amazing conversion. So the MGC was a 6-cylinder inline. Didn't build for very long. It got some pretty poor reviews because they didn't get the handling sorted on the cars. And it wasn't particularly quick. So you might as well have the V8s, and that's where the V8 carried on being made. But we've developed the C engine with special cams, roller cams, engine management system, fuel injection, and turned that into a super tourer. And our customers have got those, just rate it as possibly the best touring car they've ever had. Nice. I kind of agree with them. When you drive it, there's something about that which is spectacular. And it's the car that should have been made, but they never quite got to it.
Yeah.
So everything in the range, really, from standard V8s, standard Bs, MGCs, all of those ranges. But with all of them, we bring them up to a modern spec.
Yeah.
And suddenly...
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The car's a joy to drive again.
And that process, can you do a little run through of when a car comes in, what happens to it?
So as in like an LE build, illustration. So we've got a car downstairs, which has come from Norway. We seem to have quite a few customers in Norway. I think they're quite adventurous people and enjoy life. And he drove that car here as a V8 Roadster. And we've stripped it. The body's in incredibly good condition. We'll do any repairs or modifications so it becomes better than new. And then any additions to the vehicle that he wants to add to it, whatever they might be. And then we go through the process with every customer. We sit down and really understand what they want, really get into their psyche, and then we spec the car with them. And that's literally down to what type of suspension, what type of brakes, what type of interior. And then we start getting into the materials and the stitching, contrasting or a blend. And so our spec sheets are anywhere between sort of 3 to 7 pages long, depending on the detail of things that they want on the vehicle. Yeah. So you can literally, it's far more detailed than, say, having a tailored suit or a dress or something. You're literally going through every aspect of the vehicle, whether it be dynamically, visually, trim, safety, everything. And then fun features like champagne cabinets and little brandy holders and things like that. Nice. Some crazy things and some fun things and heated dog beds. Bike racks and all kinds of things. So you name it. It's amazing what we've done for people. And then once that spec's done, we send them a copy of the spec with then a painted model of their car, samples of the trim, all stitched up in all the designs and everything that they want to do. And they're sent to their home and they sit there and just look at on the driveway or in their house on the kitchen table and whatever, and just get comfortable and go, yeah, that's right. And then I think a large part of that is the journey of speccing a vehicle is why quite a lot of our customers come back again and again. We've got one customer who's on his third build now. And he literally said, I'm going to keep doing it because I just love the process so much. Yeah. And he uses it for a while and then he'll sell that on, let's do the next one. And that's, for me, that's the ultimate.
That's really cool.
And it's the experience that they go through there. It becomes a, for some of them, it's almost a life-changing experience because it's like, wow, can I just really get something that's just tailored for me? And it's great.
If someone's been through it like a few times, and I've heard this sort of story with some other builders of, you know, the customer has just loved the process so much that when they got to the end, they've kind of gone, oh, that's kind of it. Now. You're going to give me the car and then we're never going to talk again. Like, yeah. Oh, I want to talk again. Let's do another one. Do they, because you said at the beginning, like, you know, we're sort of like, what car do you want? What car are we going to build for you? And then I imagine you kind of go, yeah, but what do you really want? And then like, no, but seriously, like, what do you actually want? And then they've been through a build process and then they want to do another car. How does that sort of evolve? Do you think you get closer to the original in their head, possibly them? Or they go, okay, I've built this perfect car. Now I want one for a different country and I'm going to go on a different start, or I'm going to have a convertible.
It's a mixture. Sometimes it's they evolve and grow.
Which happens a lot.
So their journey changes and they go, actually, now I don't want a car that does all of those things. I want a car for doing this now. And sometimes we just make a few alterations to the vehicle. We don't need to build another vehicle entirely. Other customers already know what they want and order two vehicles to be restored. So we've got a Roadster and a GT that are going out to New Zealand soon. And this gentleman's bought one for himself and one for his dad.
That's cool.
Which is really cool. I did tell my son about it straight away.
Yeah. Do you fancy doing this in the future?
Yeah. And then we've got another customer who's got a base in Germany and in Malta. And so we built him an MGC, Sports Tourer for Malta, and a GT V8 for Germany.
Cool.
They're both completely different specs, different colours, different trim options, loads of things that are different. But he had in mind his two children, and his daughter's going to get the Roadster and his son's going to get the GT.
Nice.
At some point. I better not mention names because I don't know if they know that yet.
Yeah.
And, but they, so he specs them with them in mind as well as himself in mind.
Yeah.
And that's lovely. And it's a surprising number of cars. It's almost like a Miele watch. It's kind of going to pass on to the next generation.
That's way cooler. I feel like it's way cooler than a watch. But I wouldn't mind if someone gave me a watch either.
No, exactly. But I know. That was kind of a dream for me. I wanted people to, because when I get a car right, I don't want to stop to fill up with fuel even. I just, like, I'm enjoying the car so much. And that's what I kind of wanted to get my customers to that point where they just go, I don't want to stop driving it. I just love it so much. And we do get that with lots of them.
And it's amazing how some cars, I've got this with my 911 at the moment, where I owned a very similar car before and I didn't drive it that much. But this one I drive a lot more.
Mm.
And I was thinking about it today. It's like, sometimes you just, a car is more right or whatever, and it crosses a threshold. There's obviously some threshold where you go, yeah, but I'm going to take that one. And getting to that point is difficult.
It's a bit like making good life choices. When you make the right choice, you just know and you're comfortable with it. And if you've got a car right, which is why we spend a lot of time trying to understand our clients, to really get them to the point where we go, right, okay, you're asking for a lot of power, but you're saying actually you want to be able to go and do this tour and go to these places. And the two aren't compatible. You need to dial something back.
Yeah, something has to give. Yeah. You can't just be max.
And my goal then, or our goal as a team, is then for them to come back to us and go, thank you.
Nice.
You helped me and now I love the car, and they live with it. And you do, if you don't, if there's something about any car that you just go, so the moment you've had that sigh and you think, am I going to take that one or that one? You might as well not bother.
Yeah.
You know, and I make decisions about cars on a snap of a finger. Just literally, I sit in a car and go, no.
Yeah.
Instantly, no, I won't like this car. Sometimes I don't even drive them and just no. So, and I think instinctively you do know that, just not everybody's able to work it out or because they haven't had an experience with it. And hopefully we can help with that.
Yeah. Because if you'd asked me 10 years ago, like, for me, it would have been a 911 at that time of like, you're going to do a custom build or whatever. And you've picked, let's say, 964, because everyone does those. I would have gone, I want the fastest engine, the rawest setup, the blah, 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 at that point in time. And then a while ago, I remember seeing a video series of Gordon Murray doing a, I feel like it was maybe a Cortina or something like that with, I apologize, I can't remember what their name is, but a company. And he'd run through some engine options, I think, with Cosworth of like what they were going to do. And he'd opted for like the middle one. Because it was like a bit smaller displacement, revved a bit sweet. It didn't have as much power. Like maybe it was a bit torquier down low, that sort of situation. And I went, that's interesting. Like, why has he done that? And then now, if you said to me you could have 600 horsepower in your road car, I'd go, I don't want 600 horsepower. I've driven 600 horsepower and I don't want it. It's not going to make my life more fun. It's actually going to make it more challenging.
Possibly quite more stressful.
But that is a that is like a journey.
It is, yeah.
I wonder the idea of speccing a car and then we all change. And then possibly by the time it arrives, you want something else. It's quite interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think because we are, the vehicles we build, as you've experienced today, it's a very comfortable vehicle.
Yeah.
It soaks up all the bumps in the roads really well. And if a customer comes back to us, which they have never done yet, and said, can I have a harder suspension? We'll do that for them.
Yeah. There's not a big change.
Yeah. And that's quite easy to do. Just change the springs and the roll bars and reset the dampers and you're done. And if somebody's going to be doing, decided that, you know, they're going to turn that car into a hill climb car or something like that, fine, that's what you want. But you won't enjoy it on the road. So we don't give them that choice.
Yeah. You have some partners or an associate in Australia. How's this come about and why Australia?
So David Dyer started off as a customer. Just really love what we do. He's always loved MGs. He ran an electronics wholesale company, I think it was. But his passion was the MGs. And so when he started stepping out of that business, he said, "Oh, I'd really want to do is this." And he phoned me up and said, "Tim, I really love what you do. I'd really like to be your agent in Australia." I went, "Okay, this is cool." But I'm always cautious about these things because you need to develop a relationship with people to really get to know and work together. So he came over here a couple of times and done some work with him. And then it just grew and grew to the point where we both feel really comfortable with this. And so it was last year we formalized it and said, right, let's set it up as Frontline Australia. And so that's what we've done. So we still do some of the speccing here, still do the trim here. All the parts and everything will be shipped out there. And he's got a team of guys that can build the car, restore the car to the same standards that we do. And we've given them all the training and development for that side of it. So he's effectively our agent in Australia.
That's cool. And then does he sell mainly to Australia or other parts of that region as well?
Generally Australia, New Zealand, Australasia.
Yeah. That's cool. Is it a popular car over there?
Massively so. Yeah, the MGA is more popular. There are as many MGAs in America as there are, in Australia as there are in America. The MGB commands more status over there than it does here. As you find in most parts of the world, if you go to anywhere outside the UK, the MG commands a lot more respect than it does in the UK, oddly enough.
Yeah, I guess.
It's just kind of, I don't know
that's
why.
Funny.
I don't know
that's
why, but it always has done.
Do you think as time goes on, and because it is an older car now, the people that sort of remember it when they were young are now older.
Yeah.
Do you get getting younger people interested or a younger audience? Have you found that change? Is that something you are
until fairly recently?
About,
the younger generations weren't into this kind of thing, but now they're going, "These cars are cool." And modern cars are really boring. And if you take a badge off them, you can't tell what they are.
Yeah.
And there's no engagement to them. And so those people that want something fun and cool, they're really getting into this scene. And there's a massive diverse scene for that. But we do have quite a few younger customers and, we've got a number of celebrities as well. And they just love them. And part of it's, some of it's their grandparents had one or whatever.
Yeah.
We've got one guy who... his dad left him his MG in his will. Sorry, his grandfather left him his will in MG in his will, but left him some money as well.
Oh, nice.
And he came to us and he said, "Could you build this up to a Frontline LE50 spec?" the car was in really good solid condition. So we said, yeah, we could do that. And he's still got that car. And his dad had a go in it. And his dad loved it so much that he bought an Abingdon. So now they go and do track days together in the two MGs.
That's cool.
And that's really cool. And that's really cool. It's, you know, there's no point having a car like this or any other resto mod if you're not going to do stuff with it. If you're just going to park it in a corner and look at it, what's the point? There's got to be a purpose. And yeah, we just like to get out there and enjoy places.
It sounds like there's lots of sort of interesting stories amongst the customers of like why the build, what they're going to use it for, which fast forward 20 years or whatever, those memories, that's really cool.
Yeah. And those memories are only going to grow. We start this year doing, wife and I have done a lot of touring with the cars, but this year we're starting tours with some of our clients as well.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
And just because they want to have fun, they want to go and do things, and it might encompass going to a visit for somewhere else on the way, or go and do a bit of a morning on a track somewhere and then go for a tour around
Wales. They can see some of the new parts, the new developed things on the developed car, if possibly, you know, that was of interest.
You never know.
That's fun. I think that is, like you said, and I know you do lots of things throughout the process for sort of added value. I mean, as you're saying, someone's literally got to the end and gone, I want to do the process again. I presume none of these are sort of secrets, but you do like a book and that sort of stuff as part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's all part of the journey, and it's the, it is a journey and a process for us. We get involved in every single build and we like to get to know everybody that's having the vehicle built, and it does become a family. It feels like a family.
Do you get a lot of them back?
In terms of
resale, or when people want to get...
Resale's only just starting to happen. I think that's because of just mostly demographics. And the resale market, we have a cherished program, which Connor set up, and that's where one of our previous builds, previous restorations, they'll bring the vehicle to us, we'll inspect it. And if it's of good enough quality still, so it's not been left in a pool of salt for most of its life, we'll bring it in, service it, bring it up to spec, maybe do a few alterations to meet what the current customer's requirements are, and then offer it for resale. But we do it on a completely transparent, open book basis. So the customer, the original owner of the vehicle, receives 100% of the funds from the sale of it. And he'll then pass some to us, plus any work that he's had done. And the new owner might ask us to personalize a few things on the vehicle. And then we give a warranty to the new owner.
Nice.
So it doesn't matter how old. We've got one from 2012 downstairs. And that we're happy to put a 12-month warranty on, or 6-month warranty on that, with no issues whatsoever.
One thing I was talking about with, I think it was Connor. Is it Connor? We were talking to earlier. Yeah. Is the fact that, and I've driven early models of some well-known brand, resto mods, and I didn't necessarily like them. But I've now come back and seen the later versions. And funnily enough, when you're starting out, you're working on it and you're doing your best, but like it takes time to sort of progress. And the newer ones, I've gone, oh, actually, no, hang on a minute. What they're doing now is really good. And so I shouldn't judge them by the early ones because it's evolved. But these cars have the same name. So for example, you've got your LE50, which you're still doing, which you started 10, 11 years ago or so. Presumably, one made in year one, you've actually changed a lot since one made now.
Yes and no. There's an awful lot of processes that are exactly the same. And don't forget, we've been restoring cars for 20 years prior to that.
Yeah.
So when we actually did the LE50, most of what we did, we knew what would work. And it still applies today. There have been a few technology advancements, a few material enhancements. And then over the years, we've obviously, with higher performance vehicles, we've then developed more suspension and more brakes and or more powerful brakes. And all of those things can be retrofitted.
Okay.
To the earlier cars. So you're only really looking at those things. The fundamental car itself is still the same restored car. And if it's been looked after, you can have a look at the one that's downstairs. Yeah. It doesn't look like a 13-year-old car or 12-year-old car. it doesn't, you know, we put them next to the one that's just been built today, restored today, and you can't really tell much of a difference to it. So yeah. Lots of the things that don't, it's more the personalization that varies over the years for the customers.
Okay. Again,
most of the people having the, sort of buying a secondhand one will upgrade the suspension and the brakes because they go, why wouldn't I?
You know, yeah.
You've put the development into it. We know it's
relatively
good.
Minimal exactly. Extra
yeah.
Cost.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting seeing these things over time and how they, and in terms of, you've not sold many back, but values wise, how are they sitting versus what people have paid? And
generally, they're now about the same level, if not higher, than when they purchased the vehicles.
Nice.
Which is good. So we've got one going through at the moment. He's had it for almost 12 years and he's going to get back almost what he paid for it.
I mean, that's the dream.
Yeah.
It makes buying a lot easier.
Yeah, it doesn't adjust, yeah.
Sort of on the cards at least.
Yeah. And it's interesting, we got contacted by a company called Charles and Dean. They do
finance?
Specialist finance, yeah. And we went, why do we want to speak to somebody that does finance? Our customers don't normally do that. And they said, but you'll find some that just don't like to put all of their money into one thing. They'll spread it over several things and have several toys. And they said, well, give us some examples. And the residuals and returns that they gave us were just outrageous. Just so good. It was almost like, well, why would you
buy it? Yeah, why would you not finance it? Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm a bit old school. I don't do finance on stuff. So for me, that's like, I don't really do that, but lots of people do. So,
and if you looked at, like right now, it's a bad time, not a great time to be using finance, but 2 years ago, if you can borrow money at 2%, 1.5%, okay, car finance wasn't going to be like that, maybe 4%, and you've got a business and you're using cash and you get 8%, 10% return somewhere else, you kind of like, there's a strong case to be like, you're an idiot if you don't, but then things change. But yeah, no, it's cool to see things coming back. And that as if you're a potential customer, I think it removes a lot of worry, because we all know if you took, I think this is the beauty of having a product, like you say, rather than offering services around. Because if I came in and you didn't, it wasn't like the LE50 or LE60 or something that I bought and people know it's a frontline LE60, I go, I've got an MGB, can you do the suspension? Can you do an engine? Can you restore it? And then it comes to sale and people are like, yeah, I'll give you like $6,000 because it's like a really nice one. Like, you've spent money on it, but so what?
Yeah, so we don't do restorations of other people's vehicles unless it's a total frontline restoration,
okay,
which is everything gets stripped and everything gets restored to a better than new. So it's better than a 0 mile restoration, effectively. And then we put our name to it. And that is what commands the value further down the line, as opposed to a car that's had a bit of work done here and there. But we've got loads of customers that enjoy the process of improving their MG, and they'll set a budget of how much they'll spend each year on improving their MG, and they'll buy the parts from us and have the local garage fitted or fit it themselves. And that's, we ship the parts all over the world for people that do that. And that's a really, you know, great thing to do. But it's not the same as a frontline restored vehicle.
Okay.
That is one that we've taken back completely. Everything back to bare metal, everything to the highest possible standard, and then tailored to the individual. That's a frontline car.
And that works quite well, having the two departments as such.
Yeah. Yeah, we've always done that. We started as a parts business, but then people very quickly said, well, could you fit?
Yeah, you make all the parts, can you?
Yeah, and so we started doing that. And then people said, you know, can you do it? Yes, but your car's got some issues. We need to do some bodywork on it first. And so we started doing that. And my dad's garage that I cut my teeth on really was a mostly classic vehicles and restoration side of things, probably largely because I really liked that kind of stuff. I didn't like many modern cars even back then. And so I'd had massive experience going through that stage, and I trained in the body trade as well. I used to be a concourse paint sprayer. It was one of my early career trades, and doing like Rolls-Royce standard. Okay. Yeah. 12 layers of coat, flat it back, you know, just 12 layers of paint. Flat it back, just doing that again and again until you get this glass-like finish. Takes forever. But that's one of the things that taught me that attention to detail that you learn, and you go, if you don't do that, you know, as one of my customers said, you know, he said, I would paper behind the wardrobe because I know that it looks right behind the wardrobe rather than just paper up to the edge of it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that, you know, there's so much hidden on these vehicles that I know it makes a difference to them, that makes them drive the way they do. It doesn't matter if the customer knows, as long as they get the enjoyment out of it and they do that. And that's, you know, but that's many, many years of experience.
Yeah. And there is, like, I know now a bit more about buying classics and seeing various states of cars that, unless you, there's a huge amount of value in knowing, one, the person that's done all the work. That's obviously makes huge, but you know when it was done and you know the car's life since it was done. If someone just says this car's been restored and maybe upgraded in X, Y, Z, the reality is you don't know until you blast it back to zero.
You don't know.
You don't know. Because people are very good with filler.
Yeah, I've seen some horror stories over the years. And that's why, so we do our LE vehicles, but then we also do our bespoke vehicles. So that's where bespoke is when somebody comes along and goes, I want something that's similar to one of your LEs, but I want this, this, and this in it.
Yeah.
So it's their bespoke thing. Or they say they want an LE50 spec vehicle, but we built all of the LE50s and we said we're only going to do 50 of those, so we don't do any more of them. And so that becomes a bespoke vehicle. And then, yeah, that's kind of the process that I go through.
Because there's a green car downstairs with a tan interior.
Yeah.
It's probably quite a popular combo these days that seems to have a lot more modern sort of things in it. It's got a big display and like touch sensitive buttons or something in it and all sorts of stuff. Is that an example of someone coming to you and going,
I think that was, yeah.
I'm this sort of size.
And then, yeah. And, you know, we've got customers that have a button in the ashtray that says do not push or it's ejector seat and stuff like that. But when you push the button, a heads-up display unit appears from behind the dashboard. You can't even see anything there. It's just got an MG badge on the front of it, and then this heads-up unit pops out from behind it and stuff like that. So those are, yeah, just customer quirks. Not quirks, they're just like...
features.
I've always fancied doing this. And then occasionally we get... people who have disabilities as well. So we've done several vehicles for customers who's they've had an accident and have lost the use of their legs.
So you have hand controls and things like that?
Yeah, so hand controls and automatic transmission and stuff like that is very complicated to do. You've got to have a full engine management or gearbox management system to manage them. But I was in a wheelchair just over 2 years ago with back injuries. So it's one of those things. And I've been suffering with back pain for 10, 15 years. And so I always have a lot of empathy with people that have problems with that. And so I go, okay, we'll do it.
That must have been a bleak COVID. Was that around COVID time as well? How was that for you guys here?
For us as a company?
Well, obviously not just the personal injury, but COVID and that period.
The first week, everybody went, oh, crap, what's going to happen? And is this going to last for a week or a month or 2 months? Nobody thought it would ever go on for longer than that when it first happened. But I very quickly realized that we could categorize ourselves as engineering. So I said, right, we're staying open. Yeah. Customers, the parts business went mental because everybody just sat at home.
And just
Not spending any money. I want to get on with my car. I've been wanting to do this. I'm being paid to be at home now. I can work on my car for the next 6 months.
Yeah.
So that was, I probably worked harder at the beginning of COVID than I've ever worked in my life. And so that was really good. But then it was trying to persuade all the engineering firms to stay open as well, to keep supplying us with products, which is always very difficult. And there was so much fear at that time. And generally that it was a really draining emotional time.
Yeah.
But I knew that as a company, we're a small company, you have to keep pressing forward. You have to keep doing things. Otherwise, you know, some companies like this won't survive. And lots of them sadly haven't survived. But I think we made the right choice by pushing through. We made sure our guys were looked after properly and we distanced where we could and all those kind of things. One of the best parts of that COVID period though was driving into work because we've got some amazing roads between my house and here. And so it was just, whether I was in the car or on the motorbike, it was just like, wow, this is just amazing.
This is unbelievable.
Every day. Yeah, so I just thought, so it made me smile every day. And even though it was a grim time in many other ways, I was having fun on the roads.
That's cool. That's very cool. I got to go scuba diving at one point, during the pandemic when we were allowed to go on holiday. And you just saw loads more stuff because no one had been going diving for like 9 months. And that's never happened in the last ever.
Yeah. I'd say there were times that my wife and I bought a motorhome right at the beginning of lockdown. And we drove up to Scotland to pick it up. And we were going to come down the east coast of England, which we hadn't explored, and all of a sudden went to lockdown. I went, oh no, we can't do it. But we worked out that the west coast of Scotland wasn't in lockdown.
Oh, right, yeah.
So we drove across Scotland, went over to Mull and then to Skye. And it was my wife's birthday at the time, so it was December. It was freezing cold. But there was nobody there.
That must have been really surreal.
Yeah, it was surreal. You know, just like driving around and going, there's nobody here. Trying to find some shops that were open to buy some provisions as well.
Yeah.
And then there's a beach up on, I think it's on Mull, called Calgary Beach, which is a crescent moon beach. And it's the most beautiful white sand from coral and shells and things. And we stopped there for 2 days, didn't see a person.
Wow.
The only thing we saw were otters. And they were just diving in, bringing up shellfish and things and cracking them on the rocks. And we just stood there just watching them and just loving that. And so that's probably, that's an experience that we had during COVID that will never ever happen again in my lifetime, I wouldn't think. So there were some amazing things.
That is so cool.
Yeah. And we were very lucky.
You can't plan that sort of stuff. And like, you can't do it again because we're not in that scenario. But like the idea of a motorhome basically stocked up with provisions, because so you can at least go to a shop and get some stuff, and then like everything's shut down, everyone's working from home if you're at home anyway, so just going for a wander.
But once lockdown and COVID ended, or COVID's still around, but once it all kind of went back to normal, we then realized that we didn't actually enjoy using the motorhome when you're having to go to a campsite all the time, rather than just being able to pull up anywhere because there's nobody there to tell you not to. So we sold it.
Oh, that's interesting, because I've always had this like niggle that I want some sort of like camper van or motorhome or something. And I've done a little bit abroad on holiday and stuff.
Itch you need to scratch sometimes.
And I do need to scratch it at some point, even if it's so that I can just like drive here and then, although here's not a good example, but come here, make myself a coffee, sit in the back, do a bit of work and then go in and do the stuff. Sounds appealing.
Yeah, there's a dream in there somewhere.
There's a dream in somewhere. It's got to be sampled. I'm sure by the time, as you say, you get it, and then your vision will have changed in 2 years' time. You'll have to upgrade it, change it to a motorbike or something. Right. So I normally wrap these up with five questions.
Okay.
Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
I think that's
probably that one.
That, yeah. No, in the MGs, it was going down through France, Italy, and then down to Amalfi. That particular trip was really good. So I went down the first stage to Val d'Isère with my son. And so we drove down there, picked up some skis in the evening. So I rocked up at 7 o'clock at night with the roof down in Val d'Isère.
Nice.
And everybody's like, have you just driven here from the UK? I went, yes. We got heated seats on, nice coats on. We were fine. You know, they're all like wrapped up to go skiing.
Yeah.
So we did that a couple of days skiing. And then drove down to nearby airport when my wife flew in, son flew out,
nice.
Picked up her car and went home. And then we went to Siena, then down to Rome, then to Amalfi, then back up to Portofino. We'd actually stay in Portofino, stay just off the side of it, the Hotel Miramar, I think it was. And then from there along the southern coast, the southern north coast of Italy, then to Nice, and then back up to Paris and to the Eurostar back home again.
Nice.
So we were away for 12 days, and I think it was just under 3,000 miles, something like that.
Now, I've done 3,000 miles in a week, which is less than 12 days. Would, if you were to do a trip like that again, mm-hmm. would you take more time, or
yes, or and actually no. It was kind of, and I've got some big trips planned over the next few years. But the way we do a driving trip is we set a destination points we want to go to, and we'll just drive.
Yeah.
And if that means driving for 8 hours, we drive for 8 hours, and you get there. Unless there's things you want to stop and see along the way, we're just going.
Yeah.
We hardly ever touch motorways and toll roads. We just literally try and stay off them all the time because they are soul destroyingly boring.
Yes.
And you get there a little bit quicker, but you just feel like you've lost a day. Whereas if you enjoy the day's drive, you might still be pressing on.
Yeah, there's a lot in that.
But you've enjoyed the journey, and you might stop, go through somewhere and go, this is quite a cool place, and you just stop for a while. And that's really nice. And when I go off doing tours on my own, which I do on my motorbike sometimes, I will literally go, I want to head roughly in that direction. I want to drive for about an hour and a half. What is a coffee shop there? Yeah, fine, that's it. Yeah. That's my destination. So there's no more planning than that. And we, when we go abroad, we usually book the first night's accommodation somewhere. And after that, we book nothing. We just literally wing it and just decide where we want to go.
Nice.
Yeah, that's my kind of traveling.
That sounds like a good way of doing it.
I'm
trying to do a bit of that on these, when I'm recording these podcasts.
Yeah.
Because it's all very well being like, you know, I'm going somewhere interesting. I'm doing something interesting there. But if someone's quite far away, you spend a huge part of your day on the motorway and it's just like, it's just a dead
day. Just find somewhere interesting to stop along the way.
And it's like, I'm starting to be like, okay, can we do a bit less motorway, a bit more stopping on the way? Then you find places that are shut on a Tuesday and you're like, no toilets. Like, oh God.
I've got a portable battery-powered coffee machine, espresso machine. So that just stays in the car on the motorbike.
I've been thinking of getting one of these.
And I don't say the brand or not, but
you can say,
Utin.
Okay.
And
can you rate it?
Yeah, really good.
Okay, I think so I'll probably get
one. You can get Nespresso pods go into it, or you can grind your own coffee and tamp it in.
That sort of size?
It's like a small flask.
Cylinder type thing.
And it just all clips together. It's really easy to use. And on one charge, it'll do 5 hot coffees.
I'm getting one of these in the car.
Or it'll do something like 100 cold ones.
Okay.
So if you want a cold presso, something like that. And it's a game changer, because it means as long as you've got water with you and some snacks, you can sit down and have a coffee and just stop anywhere. You get an amazing view and you're like, right, let's have a break.
That was the thing about the motorhome slash situation that I loved, that I didn't anticipate, was driving past a beach or something, stopping, opening the door, and then being like, all right, should we have a cup of tea, cup of coffee, whatever. And you can replicate that in a car with a little coffee machine, et cetera. But that was one of the things that I'd not anticipated that I enjoyed the most. Okay, I'm going to get one of these. If you could only drive one car, a sports car, for the rest of your life, what would it be?
It would be one of mine.
And what would that be?
Probably the one you went out in today.
Okay.
I might make it a little bit less aggressive, or maybe slightly taller gearing for doing longer journeys. That is my car. You know, I don't own a modern vehicle. I've got a classic Land Rover. I've got my wife's got a modern vehicle, but that's it. You know, I've got several MGs and a classic Land Rover. So
nice.
That's it.
Interesting. Are there any modern cars that are you sort of like, not like anti-modern cars, or are there certain modern cars that are interesting to you?
I don't like it when cars take over.
Mm-hmm.
When the computer says, no, you can't do that, because I know how to drive and I want almost everything you get into. So I had a Yaris GR for a while.
Yeah.
And after the first few days of going, wow, this is exhilarating and really good fun, I started to find fault with it because the computer's still controlling things and doing annoying things. So that had to go.
Yeah.
And I won't name other brands, but there's several brands I won't even sit in because I just know they're just going to annoy me.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're mainstream, you know, mostly Germans. The Porsche doesn't fit into that category because there's some really special cars.
Any car made in 2024 comes with bongs when you go over the speed limit and like lane control. Two things that like should just die. They're not helpful.
The Mercedes lane control, I think, is possibly dangerous.
Yeah.
It just grabs the brakes and swerves the car across the road, and it's just, this is dangerous.
We'd be fine if, I don't know, we were in America and all the roads were straight and they all had big lines and whatever. But anyway, yeah.
So I do like vehicles in the Land Rover range, modern ones, the new Defender in particular. I think that drives beautifully. It's very capable. And it doesn't...
Yeah, it's good.
It doesn't argue with you. It just does what it's supposed to do. And so that's kind of... just
that's it. That's it. And I think that they have even gone to the point of, they have to have these systems on the new stuff, but they've made it in the Defender, it's for Harry's Garage video, right? And they mentioned this, they've got buttons on the steering wheel that you can very quickly cycle, just press, and disable the ones that you don't want, which is helpful. What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment?
Ooh.
Other than a Frontline?
Obviously, they're highly undervalued. LE60, yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
Highly undervalued.
I have no idea. That's not a question I've ever thought of. Honestly, don't know.
Okay.
I
older stuff, newer stuff. Is there anything you go like, oh yeah, I'd buy one of those right now. It seems like good value. Or just not, don't know.
There's a few things that I've hankered over in the past. And one of them I've just bought,
okay,
which is a classic motorbike.
Oh,
Honda VFR 750.
What? I don't know much about motorbikes.
So in his day, it was, this one's a 1990 model. It was the superbike of its day.
Right.
Finest handling. It was the innovative suspension, incredible engine. And the one I bought is in full race livery, which is what I had as a poster in my bedroom as a kid.
Oh, nice.
And so that was just a phenomenal memory for me. And it turns out this bike was the third bike of a privateer team that went to the Isle of Man to compete in the Isle of Man TT.
Okay, that's cool.
And this
cool.
was like the spare bike that never got raced. And it's been sat in a museum most of its life. So I was just lucky, right place, right time, bought that.
And you can ride this on the road?
Yeah, yeah, it's fully road legal, yeah.
Did it require a bit of recommissioning because it's not done anything? Or?
They recommissioned it for me. And then I'm now doing a few more things to it, just to upgrade.
And 90s, has it got like some electronics and stuff like that? Or not much?
But it's got some carburetors.
Okay, yeah.
It's got coil packs for the ignition. It's really old school in that respect. Analog instruments, everything. So it's just going back to the era that I kind of grew up with. And as I say, as a kid, just wanting one of these. And I was cycling through Scotland once along one of the locks and Loch Ness, actually. And one of these went past the other way. And I was like, wow, just the guy canting over on the corners. And it's like, yeah, one day.
That's cool.
And I forgot about it until I saw one back end of last year. And then I thought, went online and found this one for sale.
Yeah.
I thought, right, let's get it.
Nice.
So
that's cool.
Yeah.
Most interesting car? Anything you're looking up, Googling, like the tech of?
I can't answer anything about tech for modern vehicles because I don't keep up with it at all. Interesting vehicle. Wasn't expecting these questions. You're throwing me with these ones today.
Oh, well.
I think
that's part of it.
I like quirky things. I like things that shouldn't necessarily work. I've got my MGC race car, which you shouldn't normally use as a race car, but it works really well.
I know someone who races MGBs and his blows up all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It depends on
how you
build the engine and how you drive it.
Yeah.
If you take it to the limit all the time, it's going to blow up. But if you build it right, it shouldn't do. It should be good. And so, I like a couple of these. I've always had a hankering over the Renault 5 Turbo.
Mm-hmm.
I had a Gordini when I was younger. That was just the first fun toy car I had. That was really good fun. And another one that I had for a while, which I really enjoyed, is the only BMW I've ever enjoyed. It was a BMW 3-litre CS.
Okay.
A beautiful car. The coupe with the both windows go down on the side.
Yeah.
Really nice balanced car. And it was just a joy to drive. That went many years ago.
Nice looking thing. In terms of, I know not to talk about modern technology stuff, but are there some technologies that you use in the build design process that have changed significantly and you're now like, oh, this is exceptionally useful that didn't exist on there 20 years ago?
CAD technology is very useful, scanning. So when you're designing something to fit into an engine bay, so because you have to design everything to mount up to and bolt onto existing mounting points.
Yeah.
So you can get scan data. So you're not using a tape measure and a graph and plotting things out anymore. So your time for that and your margin for error is just almost non-existent now.
Assuming they were built to a reasonable tolerance, how are they?
Every classic vehicle, doesn't matter what make it is, they're all different.
Yeah.
You can take 5 Porsches, 5 MGs, 5 Jaguars, measure them up, the door lengths will be different. You know, there'll be fit and just things like that. So when I design something, I always design it with a tolerance or an adjustability to cope with that. And so that's kind of just something you have to do when you're designing things for older vehicles, because a modern vehicle, everything just clicks into place because they're designed with CAD. Back then, we didn't have CAD. It was all on a drafting board.
Machines that could make them, yeah.
And you know, Bob would be making the tooling for that side and Fred would be making the tooling for that side and there'd be something slightly different.
What on, let's say, the engine bay and mounting points, what sort of tolerance do you have to leave?
It's more forward-aft adjustments.
Yeah.
So, I usually work on up to 10 mil.
Okay.
Which sounds a lot, but you've got a tiny variance on the bracket that the engine mounts to on the engine and the tiny variance on the body and this, that, and the other.
Yeah, only a few things need to be out.
That's right.
10 mil.
Yeah. There's a thing in engineering called stack tolerance where if you're assembling a series of components, and you assemble them all in the correct order, you'll always get the same result.
Yeah.
But if you assemble them in a different order, you often get a different result.
Yeah, if you're one mil out on every step.
And then you could be 20 mil out by the time you get to the end of it. And so that's something that we just look out for.
Yeah. Interesting. Five-car garage. Unlimited value.
Yeah. Motorbike.
Okay.
XK120 Jaguar.
Oh, nice.
Obviously, the MGB, the MGC, the MGA. So that effectively is my five.
Yeah.
And then the classic Land Rover.
Oh, the bish bash bosh.
Yep.
And you wouldn't tweak that at all?
No, because the three MGs are very different in characteristic. So they're very different driving styles.
This is the sort of, you're in that level of nerdiness where I could say about 59 11s, wow, they're all different.
They're all so different. And that's the thing, I think, because I've never really been in the 911 world that much. I daren't say something because I know somebody will go, you're wrong on that, because I don't know. And I know my subject matter. I don't know that one.
Yeah. But yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
One more to add to it. 1954 classic Ferguson tractor.
Oh.
First vehicle I ever drove.
Right.
On my dad's forecourt. And my wife bought me one for my 50th birthday.
Nice. And do you take that to the shops?
We go to the pub.
Okay, cool.
Nice. Yeah. Look stuff fun around the garden with it. Pick up neighbours that have lost their ability to walk.
So is that, what colour is that, red?
Grey.
Grey.
The old grey Massey Ferguson.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast. Great.
Thank you for coming down and seeing what we do.
Yeah, cheers. It was good to go for a drive and meet you guys. And I'm sure I'll come back in at another point.
Yeah, brilliant.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.